Sairam listeners, and welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. I begin by offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it would be most appropriate to say the person who delivers answers to questions posted by you listeners. Yes, the answers are all Swami's, spoken by Swami on different occasions when he gave discourses, or written by Swami in the many Vahinis, or most lovingly explained by Swami to devotees and students at different times during different occasions. Thank you all for joining me week after week, sending me interesting questions, and of course being so supportive and appreciative. Talking of interesting questions, we have one interesting question this week too, and I'm going to be giving a rather detailed answer. Even then, I wonder if I will be comprehensive enough. But wait, we have time before we come to the question. So now it's time for the quote of the week, a quote which I read every day, every week, interesting quote which has caught my attention. This week's quote is from an American philosopher, and his name is Charles West Churchman. And it is a short and crisp quote. And here it is. We turn to God for help when our foundations are shaken, only to learn that it is God who is shaking them. End of quote. Well, now, isn't that a simple yet a very profound quote? Most of us can relate to it, isn't it? How many of us have had this experience of going through harrowing experiences which were so stressful when we were undergoing them? And then when we look back, we realize that thanks to those very experiences, we have turned to Swami and are much closer to Him now. And when we realize that we understand that those experiences were really speaking put there by Swami Himself. And there are a few rare occasions when Swami Himself agrees to that. A devotee once came to Swami for the cure of his daughter who had the disease of polio. He was a very, very rich man, and probably this was the only one thing troubling him. And Swami then spoke to this devotee. Swami explained, "It is I who gave her this ailment because I wanted to draw you and your family close to me." Swami may say it to a few, but it is true for all of us. And imagine once this idea is established in our mind, that the one who shakes us and the one who is going to ensure our protection is one and the same, what will happen to our approach to life? We will lead life like we are taking rides in an amusement park. We will just enjoy the adrenaline rush and abandon all fear. That would be some exciting journey. So dear listeners, before we head to the question, permit me to read the quote by Charles West Churchman one more time. I quote, "We turn to God for help when our foundations are shaking, only to realize that it is God who is shaking them." Heading to the question of this week, this question is sent to us by a young sister who wishes to be anonymous, so we'll let her be so, but it's an interesting question, and I have Sister Sumana reading out the question for us. So let's listen to the question, and at the end of it, let's see what is the explanation that Swami has given to all of us.
Saira, I'm at the beginning of my spiritual path and have a lot of questions about quite a few mundane situations in my life. In most cases, I can find answers by listening to different programs on Radio Sai. Thank you so much for making this possible. This time, I felt the need to ask directly the following question that has been bothering me for quite some time. I would like to know Swami's view on the different types of romantic relationships between women and men that exist in the modern Western world. In particular, I would like to know, in the eyes of God, what defines marriage between two people and whether two people need to be married to be together. Two people need to bond their relationship through traditional practices such as legal or spiritual marriage with wedding rings or other attributes that society requires for a married couple? Or can a woman and a man be together in a relationship without any of the society required procedures and consider each other as a family based on their strong belief that they are destined to be together. Is this bond blessed in the eyes of Swami? I guess I am a little lost and confused since I am surrounded by current and rather frivolous viewpoints on the relationships between men and women, and I don't have anyone to ask for advice, that is, given within the spiritual path I have chosen. And I don't really know what is expected and appropriate for a young single woman, especially if her health doesn't allow her to have children and fully take care of a family the way traditionally is expected from a wife. Please help. Thank you, and sayonara.
Thank you very much for that question. It's a very important one. I'm not sure if the questioner has Indian roots, but nevertheless, this is one thing that Swami would point out, one quality or one feature of Indian culture that Swami would point out and say that this is a remarkable feature, is one thing, that is the synthesis of the worldly aspects and spiritual aspects of life, that we should not separate them. And Swami would say that if you really want to lead an Indian style of life, or Bharatiya style, not necessarily Indian style of life, then you have to ensure that you don't separate the worldly and spiritual matters in your life. And in that sense, this is a very important question, because we cannot keep out spirituality from these kind of decisions that we have to make in life. So thank you for asking that question, and I think it gives us an opportunity to speak about this, especially given the, as you rightly mentioned in your question itself, frivolous viewpoints on the relationships between men and women that exist in the modern society. To start with, from your question, there are basically three or four issues that we can discern from the way you've articulated your question. Point one, what does Swami say about the different types of relationships between men and women, especially the modern ones? Point two, is it necessary for a ritual like marriage for a man and woman to be married in that sense and live together? The question three is, will Swami approve of a union which does not involve such ritualistic procedures or legal bondings? And the last point is, what if a person is not in a physical condition that does not permit the raising of a family in the traditional sense? I'll make a very short answer to that towards the end, right in the end. Well, to start with, you know, when you say modern relationships, I think you're referring to trends which are catching up now, like live-in relationships, no-strings-attached relationships, or maybe even some weird technology-aided dating processes, which is very popular nowadays. I can't speak much about them because, honestly, I'm not very conversant with all of them. But nevertheless, you will agree that many of these are very, very superficial and very hollow in their approach. So does Swami approve of such relationships? Certainly not. Swami has said in no uncertain terms on many, many occasions that he does not like the idea of two individuals of opposite genders mingling intimately in the name of being boyfriends and girlfriends. In fact, this is something which Swami would see very, very often when he's speaking to youngsters, students groups, especially when Swami is speaking to youngsters who come from the West. Swami would say that if you like someone, get married and stay married, importantly, and don't go on endless friendships. In fact, whenever Swami speaks about the attribute of friendship, Swami would always say that there's only one person who's a true friend and only God is a true friend. So be very careful about using this word friend very, very, liberally and going around making friends, especially at particular ages, right? You know, especially that what we refer to as young adult or the phase between late teenage and middle age. Especially at that time, it's very important that we be careful about the company that we keep. Talking about, the ritualistic marriage, you know, where when Swami says that don't go on endless friendships, if you like someone, get married, on many, many occasions, Swami has himself performed marriages. Swami has himself inspired people to solemnize their relationship through a process of marriage. So Swami's stance is very, very clear. Before I explain into why Swami is very particular about this and why, especially if you choose a spiritual life, a spiritual path, because that's what your question is all about. You said that I'm starting on a spiritual journey, and so this is very, very important for that. So let me begin, before everything else, with a very brief history on this institution of marriage and how it has led up to these modern methods that I just mentioned in the beginning. You know, in most early societies, this is not just confined to India or some cities in the Orient, some communities in the Orient or Middle East. This was predominantly everywhere. In most cases, the women in the society were economically dependent on man. That's how most of the societies were. So when this was the scenario, when people would get married, at the starting point itself, women were at a certain disadvantage in that. Economically, they were dependent, and biologically too, men had a certain advantage because of the fact that it was the women who were bearing the children, right? Given this advantage, what happened was, over the generations, over the centuries, men began misusing this advantage that they had. And also that in the previous centuries, there were these migrations which were happening. The men used to travel a lot. And given that, they would, in many cases, the men would abandon their wives, right? So when they would get married, what is the word that they would give? They would give the word that they would take care of this individual and the children the individual bears for them for the rest of the life. And that is what a marriage vow is all about. But when they would break the vow like this and take disadvantage of the advantage that they have in a marriage relationship, this started happening very often. And so the law of the land had to step in, right? So what happens when the law of the land steps in? How can the law work in a situation like this? The law will have to start treating marriage as a contract, with terms and conditions, with penalties, with modes of termination and annulment. The law will have to treat a marriage as a typical contract between two parties, right? That's how it all happens. So what happens when this happens is, one thing, when the law steps in, the boundaries between morality, the boundaries of morality start getting blurred. How does that happen? Now we will start seeing everything involved in that relationship through the process of, is it legal or is it illegal, right? What was a social contract? A marriage between a man and a woman was a social contract. An agreement over a certain kind of ritual depending on where you come from. And the vow was, the man gives the vow that I will consider this person and the children that this person bears as my responsibility, and I'll take care of them for the rest of my life. This was a social contract. Now when the law steps in, it becomes a legal contract. And what happens when the law steps in is, till that point when it's a social contract, the morality, which will be based on spirituality, right? There is a certain purpose behind this contract. I will come to that later. So the moral codes of a relationship like this will be based on spiritual values. But once the law steps in, the moral code will now be based on the legal tenets, right? It will be based on legality. So when that happens, the boundaries of morality starts changing. And that is precisely what has happened to the institution of marriage. Once the legal system steps in, it stepped in for good reason, because as I said, individuals were misusing the social obligation or the social contract, and that is how the law steps in. Now what happens after this is, now when a man breaks away from a marriage, and they needed to come up with some way by which he is held responsible for breaking the vow. So that is how the concept of the alimony comes, right? Alimony is where the man is expected to pay for the upkeep of the wife, or the spouse that he is abandoning, and for the children. In the earlier years, this concept was merely a concept because nobody was making so much money. But as individual incomes started growing, the alimony started being enforced. So invariably, the alimony had to be paid, and slowly the amounts of alimony started increasing. And now with this clause, it so happened that in many societies, the women started misusing this clause in the Marriage Act. So what would happen is, there was a series of cases where the women would get married to very rich men and file for a divorce and walk away with a huge chunk of the property of the rich man, right? So this was happening continuously, and this was a classic case of an immoral living within the legal framework. Because what they were doing was absolutely immoral, but it was within the law, so there is no questions to be raised. And this is precisely what happens when legality steps into the realms of social morality. Next, what happens is with increase in gender neutrality, the debate became, why should a man pay for a woman when you say that a woman is not dependent but an equal? So it started blurring the line. Now alimony started becoming both ways, depending on who is earning more. If a man is earning more, he pays alimony when there's separation. If the woman is earning more, then she pays alimony to the man. And now this started being misused by men also. So now all of this, what does it do? It makes this getting into this legal contract and getting out of it more and more complex and tiresome. It makes that process very, very hard. And eventually what happens is, all of this leads to people losing faith in the institution of marriage itself, right? Now, to circumvent this, what does it happen? It becomes even more difficult to get into a marriage and come out of it. So what happens is, two people get together and they say, we like each other, we want to share our life with each other. Why get into this cumbersome process of a legal marriage or a ritualistic marriage? We have understanding between each other, so let us live together, forget about the marriage. And this is precisely how what we call as live-in relationships come to be. In a certain sense, this is an acknowledgement of the fact that the marriage should always be a social relationship, a social contract. So literally, it has gone back to how the marriage started off with. They have found a way by which they can keep the legal system outside, and the marriage can continue to be a social understanding between two individuals. Right. So does that mean that these new age concepts such as live-ins and no strings attached relationships are the way forward? Is that what I'm suggesting? Are they morally valid? No, they are not. And we will see why that is the case. In the beginning, I made a point that moral codes and ethics should be based on spirituality and not on legality. Right. What does that really mean? I've given this definition of spirituality before and in the programs that I've done so far. Spirituality, nothing means but going into the spirit or the essence of the matter, right? In anything that we do, any decision that we take, the ability to go into the spirit of the matter and make that decision, and to constantly be able to have that kind of a spiritual perspective is nothing other than what is a spiritual life, right? In other words, there is always an underlying purpose, and our actions and choices are truly moral if they are aligned with that essential purpose. And that is what we mean by saying that when the moral codes that we follow are based on spirituality, when the moral codes are based on legality, you will only see whether it is permissible under law. Are you breaking any law? And many times, the example which I gave with people misusing the concept of alimony comes from that. You know, when you are absolutely aligned with the law, but you are no more aligned with moral principles. So that brings us to the question of what purpose is meant to be served through the institution of marriage, right? And if we can understand that, then we can ensure that whether we follow these rituals of marriage or not, does it serve the purpose that the institution of marriage is supposed to serve in our lives? And in other words, we can also see, does these ritualistic processes or ceremonies and the legal process, does it in any way help us serve the purpose of marriage, what it is meant to provide? There are 3 points that I'm going to make, and all of these 3 points are specifically made by Swami as the purpose of marriage, right? Point number one, it helps us in this journey from I to we, and from we to I, or we to he, or we to God, as you would like to see it. The spiritual journey is essentially this: from our selfish selves, we go to a certain amount of selflessness, and through this process of selflessness, we turn towards this inner self, or the real self, or God, as you would like to see. So this is the essential, the essence of a spiritual journey put in one sentence. It is from I to we, from we to the real I. So if this is what we are meant to go through, Swami says that when we keep thinking of ourselves and our needs, and you know, this is what I need, this is what I like, this is what I want, you are in the state of selfishness. And to move away from this state of selfishness, the marriage, the concept of marriage is very, very helpful. Where one more person comes and the person is dependent on you, and that person's joys depend on your actions and choices. So automatically, it enables you to move from selfishness to a certain amount of selflessness. So that is one of the key purposes of marriage. So Swami says that in the marriage, we are meant to learn qualities such as forbearance, acceptance, and such virtues which stem from selflessness. And in fact, I had spoken at length in an earlier answer on this topic, how the scriptures say that these qualities of selflessness, forbearance, are qualities that literally prepare your mind for the spiritual quest. And in the past, children would be taught the importance of these qualities. And then when they step into the phase of marriage, it would be a means of testing their knowledge of these qualities or their imbibing of these qualities, and will also help them develop these qualities. That's why traditionally in the Indian system, you would have the student phase, where the person is meant to be a celibate, where the person is taught about all of these qualities, but then he is encouraged to go into the grihastha phase, or the householder phase, where he literally cements these values in himself when he goes through this process, right? So, I mean, this is something which I had mentioned earlier, and in that answer where I had mentioned this, I also spoke about how forbearance is learning to live with the choices that we have made. I would, in fact, suggest that you go and listen to that answer where one particular person had asked, what is it that we need to teach our children when they come to the point of choosing a partner for themselves? So this, I had made this point there that, you know, when we talk about forbearance essentially means learning to live with the choices that we've made. So if we keep making choices, when I mean keep making choices, I refer to keep changing our partners, keep making choices and changing our partners, we will never learn the quality of forbearance, which comes after the choice is made, right? So in this particular point, and this particular point is a reason why such modern social contracts are wrong, right? Though I said that it is going back to a legal contract being a social understanding between two individuals, the reason why it is wrong is that the idea of going into a no-strings-attached relationship is based on the need to keep making choices and changing partners. To facilitate this hassle-free change of partners, people try to circumvent traditional marriages or legal marriages. And that is one of the reasons why it is wrong, right? And that's why Swami says marriage should not be for a few days, weeks, months or years. You should look for long marriages, marriages that will last a lifetime, because only then will the concept of marriage serve the purpose of breeding a character, right? This is what Swami himself says. Point number two, the second purpose that marriage is meant to serve. Yes, marriage is indeed meant for companionship and sharing too, right? I can't overlook that point. In fact, there was one particular answer that I handled, which was about when the path of spirituality is a path of solitude, why is it that we seek companions in the path? And I had mentioned in that where as long as we have pain, as long as we have elation and sorrow, as long as we are pulled from one end of this to the other, in the name of happiness and sorrow, we will need this, we will have this desire to share, right? And that is why companionship always is an inbuilt desire in all of us. And marriage, Swami says, gives us an legal option for that, right? Swami says, it gives us a legitimate way by which you can choose a partner and enjoy this companionship for a lifetime. So Swami says marriage does serve this purpose, but sometimes giving too much importance to this aspect is also very dangerous, because the moment we find that we are not able to share what we want to share with the partner, or the partner is no more as welcoming and as comforting as before, again, this we go into the cycle of making another choice and choosing another partner. So this aspect is very important, certainly important, but too much emphasis on this is dangerous. In fact, all the three points that I'm going to mention are equally important. If you give too much importance to any one of the three purposes of marriage, then I think it is going to be dangerous. So the first point I made was that it is meant to teach us qualities such as forbearance and understanding and selflessness. The point two that I made was marriages are meant for giving companionship, giving us an accepted, socially accepted means of having companionship with another person. Point number three, which is very, very important, and it is very necessary that we look at it, and this is again something that Swami has himself said, end of the day, we all live in a body, and the body has some basic instincts. And one of that is the carnal cravings that the body comes with. And these have to be dealt with in a manner that they do not harm us, and certainly that they do not harm people around us, right? Swami says that end of the day, the body, though it is, we call it a human body, it is a mammalian body, it's an animal body, right? It is the human mind which makes us live a human life and not an animal life, right? So these qualities are inbuilt within the human frame, and these have to be dealt with, right? But Swami says that even within the marriage, these cardinal cravings could wreak havoc. So it is very important to keep a very general rule in mind. So yes, there is this thing of this basic instinct which is there in each one of us, and we need to give a legitimate way of expressing it, and that's what marriage is. And this can be achieved in two ways, right? One is through the legitimate, socially acceptable means to satisfy these cravings, which marriage is. And the other is, as I said, even within a marriage, there needs to be a certain amount of control of all of these things. So to handle this, there is a very basic concept which I'll talk about. And, this is not just for such desires and pleasures, but this is for all sorts of pleasures that we undergo in life. Generally, if we want to have a cap on the amount of pleasure that we have, the pleasure seeking that is inbuilt nature of us, if we have to control this, this concept is very, very important, right? Especially when we choose to lead a spiritual life. Let me make that even more clear. And I don't know, I might have made a reference to this in a past answer too. All activities that give us some sort of pleasure always have a certain purpose attached to it, right? The pleasure seeking never comes without a purpose. We find, for example, pleasure in eating, the process of eating. We all enjoy eating, but it always comes with the purpose attached, and that purpose is the nourishment to the body, right? I'm not going into why the body has to be taken care of. Yes, we all know that it is the vehicle for doing good actions, which is the very purpose for which we've taken a human birth. So, but for the pleasure of eating, the purpose attached is the purpose of nourishing this body, right? For instance, another example you can think of is the pleasure of sleeping. You know, we all enjoy having good sleep. What is the purpose of that pleasure? It is because it keeps our mind refreshed. As much of the sorting out in the mind happens when we go to sleep. And I mean, that's a different science altogether. So there is a pleasure in doing the activities such as eating and sleeping, but there is always a purpose attached to it. But if we detach the pleasure from its purpose and indulge in the pleasure without any restraint, then the purpose gets hurt. So excess eating results in the spoiling of health, where the purpose was actually the nourishment of the health, but excess indulgence in eating is going to spoil the health. Similarly, excess sleeping is going to make us lethargic and actually eventually harm the mind, right? So that is why this concept of not detaching pleasure from the purpose is very, very important. So even these carnal cravings that are inherent in all of us, right, is a natural feature meant for procreation. That is the purpose for which it has been given. It does not come without a purpose. Yes, there is pleasure involved, but if we focus only on the pleasure involved and try to indulge only in the pleasure, it will seriously jeopardize our spiritual journey, right? That's why I said initially, if we have chosen to lead a spiritual journey, this is very, very important. Yes, there is pleasure involved in these indulgences, but if we concentrate only on the pleasure and forget the purpose, and this is going to harm our spiritual journey. So even within the marriage, as much as possible, we must not detach the carnal pleasure from the purpose of such instincts as much as possible. That's why Swami makes an important point that marriage is meant to aid self-control. I think this is a very important point that Swami says. This is something I think Swami said on the occasion when he was performing a mass marriage, that marriage is meant to aid self-control. I had made a point of brahmacharya or celibacy, right? You know, in the phase where we are a student, this is something which is always spoken of as an important quality. Celibacy is an important prerequisite for the spiritual journey. But Swami says that one can follow celibacy even after marriage. And Swami makes this beautiful point. He says, a man must be a celibate in the company of all women other than his wife. A woman should maintain celibacy in the company of all men other than her husband. So literally, marriage is an accepted dharmic means of satisfying one's basic physical needs. And that is one of the key purposes of marriage. And this is what Swami has himself said. You know, Swami would often refer to the four purusharthas, or the four goals of human life: dharma, artha, kama and moksha, where dharma is righteousness, artha is wealth, there's little more to that, I'll come to that, kama is desires or pleasures, and moksha of course is liberation, which is the ultimate goal that we all are after. Now artha is said to be pursuit of wealth and kama is pursuit of desires. But as I'd mentioned earlier in a different show, artha does not mean just money, but all forms of wealth. Right? Why do we actually seek wealth? The reason why we seek wealth is because we believe that wealth gives us a certain amount of security, right? So it includes anything, artha includes anything which we pursue with the hope that it will give us some form of security. So in that sense, even companionship is a form of artha. So this artha and kama, Swami says, should be pursued through dharma. Right? That is the explanation which Swami would give when he talks about the purusharthas, dharma, artha, kama. Swami would say kama and artha, pursuing wealth and pursuing pleasures, is not wrong, but only ensure that it is within the bounds of dharma or righteousness. Right? So marriage is a dharmic means for the pursuit of companionship and the pleasures of the body. This is something which is very, very important that we must remember. So as I said, there are three reasons. One is, of course, marriage makes us selfless. Marriage makes us move away from selfishness on this journey of selflessness. But the two other points, it is a legitimate means for companionship, and that is the second point. Companionship is one of the reasons why we seek, or why marriage is a good option. And the third one I said was, it is to satisfy the cardinal cravings which are inbuilt in man. It is not a demonic quality. It is a human quality, but to give it unrestrained access, that becomes a demonic nature or animal nature. So Swami says that this seeking of companionship and seeking of fulfillment of these desires, which is nothing but artha and kama, the ability to put it in a dharmic context is what marriage offers. So why do we need a social ceremony to mark marriages, right? That is the next point, and that's, I think, one of the important questions that you raised. Is it necessary to have a ritualistic process? Is it necessary to have it in a social ceremony? And of course, is it necessary to go through a legal process? The reason for why the legal process is required, I mentioned it. You know, there, though I said that when legality steps in, morality gets blurred, it is not to undermine the importance of the legal angle to institutions such as marriage, because the legal angle has been beneficial to many, many people who were at a disadvantage in relationships like this. So it is not to undermine the importance of that. It definitely has its role. It has played its part. But when we approach an institution such as marriage, it is important to remove the legal angle from our mind. That is what I was saying, that we can still look at marriage as a social understanding between two individuals or two families. We need not be having the legal angle in our mind when we are approaching the institution, right? So going back to the question of why do we need a social ceremony to mark this marriage? And is Swami particular about this? That is what we are worried about, right? It's not about what the pundits say. We are worried about what is Swami's view on that. Yes, certainly. And Swami does say it is important that one commits to the spouse. And more importantly, it is acknowledged by the society, right? That the society should consider that, yes, here is a couple. And that is what a social ceremony is all about. That you take vows, you accept each other as companions for life, but it is done in the presence of many others, which means you are literally taking the consent and the acknowledgement of the society to say that, yes, henceforth, these two individuals are going to live a life of companionship. The reason for that is a very important point that Swami makes, which is much larger than just the context of marriage that we are talking about. Swami says that we live in the society, and more importantly, we live off the society. And all the favors that we receive from society is based on the moral codes and conducts in a society, right? We speak about dharma being very, very important. There is a very beautiful definition of dharma. Dharma is a very complex word. It means righteousness, it means duty, it means religion. But the root of the word dharma comes from the fact it literally means that which brings order. So Swami would say that when a group of individuals come together to form a community or form a society, they invariably set up a certain number of code of conducts. And the reason why they set up these is for the smooth functioning of that society. A simple thing like if you want to have traffic on a road, you need to have some form of rules and regulations that all of us together decide that, yes, we will all follow this so that it benefits each other, right? So Swami says that when a society comes together and sets aside that these are the codes of conducts we will follow, the reason why the society does that is for the benefit of everybody, right? So Swami would often say that when you go out into the society, you have to ensure that you lead your life within these code of conducts that the society lays. We'll go back into the concept of the marriage that we're talking about. You know, what would happen, especially in conservative societies? It is still true when we talk about villages in India, and I'm sure in many other small communities which are very conservative. The society will have a means of putting soft pressure on the individuals living in the society to stick to certain moral codes of conduct. How does it do that? For instance, I spoke about how a couple get married in a social ceremony where everybody acknowledges that, yes, these two people have got married, right? When that happens, the society will expect that this couple lead a life in a certain manner. When you don't lead a life in a certain manner, let's say that there is no harmony between the two of you and there is a separation that happens, this is not a legal system. Let's just remove the legal system for now. Let's imagine that there is no legal angle to this whole scenario. The society will not have any hard and fast ways of enforcing that you follow these dharmic rule of rules or codes of conduct. But the society will have a means of putting soft pressure on you and ensure that you lead a good life. Imagine something like a rating system, a credit rating system. You have these agencies which give you credit scores, right? Depending on that, you're either worthy to go and take a loan or not. Something of that sort. Society starts rating you based on your actions on a day-to-day basis. And then eventually, when there are occasions when you turn to society for certain benefits or certain favors that you want, you will be treated according to the rating that you have got. This is nothing but the name and fame that you have earned in society. So there is no legal angle. You're not going to be punished for it. You're not going to be, nobody is going to say that you can't do this or you can do this. But in a very undercover manner, the society enforces some rules and regulations on you. And if you don't follow it, your fame ratings or your whatever name ratings, whatever you'd like to call that, starts falling. And that inhibits the way you can freely live in the society. So this was actually a very beautiful model by which, the need for a legal system to step in to make the husband lead a life properly or make the wife lead a life properly was not there. And this was actually a very important thing. And even though the legal system has stepped in, as much as possible, if we can live in society with this kind of a pressure on us, because this is something which in the modern society we always despise. We always ask this question, why are people bothering about us? Why don't people mind their own business? But this is actually a very important feature of social living, and Swami has himself emphasized this. Swami would often sing one padyam where he says, Satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram, or something of that nature, where Swami says that kirti, or the name that you earn in society, Swami equates it even to the ultimate truth. Swami says that is so important. Because Swami says that if we lead a life in society in such a manner that we do not get any bad name, and if we get a good name, if we live with good reputation, that will itself ensure that we predominantly lead a righteous life in our personal family and otherwise the life that we lead in the society. And that is why this becomes very important, and that is the reason why something like a private relationship between a man and a woman, which is what marriage is done in the presence of many, many people from the society, so that you're acknowledged as a couple, and henceforth this soft pressure of what the society expects from you as a couple will be there, and to an extent it will keep you on line with what you're supposed to do. So this was a means by which the legal angle was kept aside, and the society will always be very particular about the moral values. And as I said, these moral values will not be dependent on legality, but will be dependent on the spiritual code of conduct. And this is what Swami refers to as Sanghaniti. Sanghaniti literally means the social code. When a group of individuals come together and form a code or a set of rules by which they want to define their community or their social gathering, when you go into that and become part of that society, Swami says it is your bounden duty to follow and fall in line with all this code of conduct. And Swami says that is what Swami refers to as Sanghaniti. And this is a way by which you will lead a moral life, the pressure that the society puts on you. But the problem is, it comes to the point where you're talking about modern societies. And in fact, Swami has spoken enough about the nature of modern societies, the nature of our modern cities, be it in India or be it in the West, where the moral level of the society itself is on the decline. And when that is the case, the amount of pressure that the society will place on you to lead a moral life is going to slowly wither away, right? You talk about live-in relationships. What has happened now is, over a period of time, this is beginning to become a norm in the society. The society accepts it, so no more it's going to be looked at as a weird way of companionship, right? So when that happens, the moral effect that a society has on an individual withers away. Right? And interestingly, that is what is the definition of the Kali Yuga, right? When we talk about Kali Yuga becoming bad, Swami says Swami would give that example of Dharma standing on one foot in the Kali Yuga, which means the general moral level of the society falls. So the moral angle of, the social angle, the societal angle of you leading a moral life, the influence the society has on you starts decreasing. And when that happens, you will have to stand up as an individual on your own. And that explains some of the other rituals which are involved in any kind of marriage. I'm not talking about Indian marriages, be it the marriages in the West or in any other society. What is that? Be it a Christian marriage, every marriage will have this angle of, you know, the vows being taken probably in a church, in a temple, in a synagogue, or in front of a symbol of divinity, be it the Bible, the Gita, or the fire in Indian marriages. I don't know about the other marriages, but there'll always be a symbolism where the vows are taken in front of someone or a symbol which we consider as divinity, right? The reason why this is an important aspect of any ritualistic marriage is, now you are not, on one hand, the witness is the society, the gathering which is there. On the other hand, the witness is God Himself. So now you're saying that I will take care of this person, I will be care for this person, I'll be understanding towards this person, or whatever it is the marriage vows are. You are taking that vow in the presence of God Himself. And now the more and more you start deviating from the promise that you're given, you are accumulating demerit. You are accumulating sin in that sense. So whether or not people are putting that force on you, whether or not society is bothered about you, let's say that you've taken a marriage vow, you've got into a marriage, and you're living in a society which does not care about how you live, whether you are living harmoniously or you're fighting. But you will have this conscience picking you that I made these promises in the presence of God, and as we say in Indian tradition, Agni Sakshi, as fire as witness, as God as witness, right? When I've made these vows, it is my duty, whether or not people are looking at me, whether or not it's legal or illegal, whether or not the society is pressurizing me to do that, it is my duty to ensure that I do not break the vows that I've taken. So that is the second aspect which Swami speaks about, Sanganiti. Swami would say Papa Bhiti, where you have the fear of demerit, fear of sin, where that starts regulating your actions more and more. So Swami would say that, you know, in the modern age where the Sanganiti aspect starts waning away, it becomes very important for this Papa Bhiti aspect to start coming in, the fear of sin. Well, again, talking about Kali Yuga, where I said, you know, where morality itself starts getting diluted, what happens is when the legality comes in, we're not sure what are the moral principles. Why are we doing certain things? What is the purpose of certain actions? So we only start looking at our sins even on the basis of, is it legal or illegal, right? And that is why eventually Swami says in the Kali Yuga, as much as possible, as long as all your actions are based on the third aspect which Swami speaks about, which is Deva Preeti, which is your love for God. It is not about whether it's sin or it's acceptable, is it legal or illegal, or what do people think of it, will people look at me and make fun of me, will it lead to ill reputation. You're not worried about any of those things, but you're constantly only taking decisions based on, you know, is this acceptable to Swami? You know, I am answerable only to Swami. Is it acceptable? And only out of that love for Swami that you do that. And that is probably the best way the marriage or any such understanding can work out. So in that sense, yes, you know, this is the necessity for probably solemnizing a relationship such as marriage through the process of either of a legal process or of a social process or a social ceremony, as I said. These are the reasons. And Swami does say that, you know, you have to do this. Is there any other reason for which two individuals would get into something like a live-in relationship other than the fact that they don't want to commit to each other? They don't want to be very particular that I've committed and I'm going to live this for a lifetime. Swami says that make sure, you know, whether when you get into a marriage, keep this very, very clear in your mind that you are doing this for a lifetime and not for a certain period of time. When you're very sure of that, why should you hesitate to solemnize this relationship in the form of a social ceremony or a legal marriage certificate, whatever it is? So Swami says that make it very clear in your mind. And sometimes, you know, these actions that we do are expressions of what we keep in our mind, right? That is something which is very important to do. For instance, you would see that many of the rituals that we perform has a physical activity involved. Especially if you see most of these rituals that we do in temples, there are these things where they take spoonfuls of water and they pour it down. The reason is, in the mind they're thinking of something like, I offer this to God, I offer my body to God, I offer my mind to God. And the rituals are a means of, are a means by which this abstract thinking that goes on in mind is attached to a physical manifestation in the form of some ritualistic way by which you express what you're thinking in your mind. So if you have thought in your mind that here is a companion and we have this understanding, we're going to live with each other with life, don't hesitate to express that in the form of a ceremony, in the form of a marriage. I think that's what Swami suggests, that this is what you have to do. And constantly see if you are sticking to the purpose for which this ceremony is meant. I think that will ensure that you are on the track. You know, that is the most important thing. The last point that you asked, the last question that you asked, what if a person is not physically fit to lead a married life in the traditional sense? Well, that was only one of the purposes of marriage, as I said, right? You know, to be able to procreate and to be able to bring children into the, to bring up righteous children into the society, right? That is one of the important purposes of marriage. If that does not serve, it certainly helps in the other two important aspects which I spoke about, which is selflessness and, of course, the ability, the selflessness and, of course, the companionship angles which the marriage offers us. So in that sense, if you find a necessity for that, you can go into these things. But of course, there are certain means by which this concept of marriage is not mandatory. Well, I will not go into that now. If you can serve the purposes of marriage without going through this process of marriage, and if you're sure that you're able to do that, then marriage is not necessary for a person. But if you're able to sublimate your carnal instincts, if you're able to achieve this selflessness, and if you don't find this craving for companionship, yes, you can go through life without this. But if you have made up your mind to go in for this, I think it is always advisable to go in through these traditional methods which Swami speaks. In fact, Swami would always emphasize on this. There are many, many occasions where people have come to Swami. In the 70s and 80s, a lot of Westerners used to come to Swami, and they would come as boyfriends and girlfriends, and Swami would so beautifully sit and explain to them the need for, getting married. Swami would say, don't endlessly live in a relationship like this. And on many occasions, so lovingly, Swami himself has performed the wedding, and Swami would traditionally bless them with all these mantras, which the pandit would usually use when he's performing a marriage like this. And out of love, Swami has done all of this to show us the importance of some of these ceremonies. And as I said, this is a very, very important aspect of life where many of us get misled. You know, this will not be crimes in the eyes of society, because the society, as I said, is losing its moral fabric in most cases. And this will not even be seen as wrong or sins. But if we choose a spiritual life, the most important quality of a spiritual life is to lead a purposeful life. If we lead a purposeful life, automatically we will be leading a spiritual life, and eventually we will head towards the goal. And one of the ways by which you lead a purposeful life is not to run away from pleasures. This is something which Swami often says. It does not mean that you completely run away from pleasures, but ensure that always the pleasure that is being enjoyed does not become counterproductive to the purpose which is attached to that pleasure. And that is the basis of everything that Swami says in terms of sailing on desires or having control over our senses and our mind. So probably to quickly summarize what I said so far. I spoke about, you know, why a social contract such as a marriage became a legal contract. It all starts with immorality within the relationship. And of course, initially it was because of the men taking advantage of the, of their position in a scenario such as marriage, and how the legal system steps in. And once this institution of marriage becomes more complex, more and more it is misused, people start losing confidence in this institution. That is how they turn towards other forms of social contracts where the legal system is kept outside. It is not right to do that because it is based on this need to keep making choices and keep changing partners. And that is one of the reasons why it is not right. And it is also very, very superficial. You know, I spoke about some of these dating apps and all of that. In earlier scenarios, when Swami would speak about the marriages which our epics speak about, always it would be the name of the person reaching each other. The person, the girl or the boy would hear about the glorious qualities of that person that she's going to marry. And the last thing would be to see the physical appearance of that person. But today it's the exact opposite. You know, you have an app where you look at the person's photo and you see whether you like that person or you don't like that person, whether that person is suitable to you or not. So this whole process of choosing partners has become so superficial, and that is why an institution such as the modern ways of live-ins and no strings attached relationships are counterproductive to a spiritual journey. And then I spoke about how it is very important to stick to the purpose of the institution of marriage. The purpose is being threefold. One is it helps us become selfless and develop qualities such as forbearance and such. The second is it gives us a legitimate means of companionship. The third is it gives us a legitimate expression for some of the carnal cravings which are part of this human life. And I spoke about why it is important to have a social ceremony. Why was the need for a social ceremony emphasized over the years? The reason being, Swami says that if we lead a life by which we follow the rules and conducts of the society we live in, that takes care of a good part of our moral living. Sangha Niti is very important, and that's why many of these traditional ceremonies would be done in the presence of the social gathering, so that you are, you know, you do it in the witness of the society. That is the idea. But as I said, in Kali Yuga, the control that the society has on your moral life starts waning. That is why it becomes an important thing for being individually upright, right? And that is where the fear of sin and the love for God comes in. And in fact, Swami would often say this, that whenever he speaks about Kali Yuga, however bad the society can become, if an individual chooses to lead a morally upright life, like in this case what I had explained as Swami's message, then the effect of Kali Yuga will not be on this individual who is living an upright life. And so in that sense, it all comes down to doing everything for the love of Swami. And I think that is why the question that you asked was so important, because you asked, what is Swami's views on this? And that is what is most important to all of us. It is not about, is it right, is it wrong, is it legal, is it illegal? It is about what is Swami's views on it. And it may appear very, very conservative to us, but be sure that if Swami has a certain view on any aspect of our life, it can only mean that that is what will lead us into our spiritual goal. So if you want to lead a spiritual life, this is certainly important. So thank you very much for asking that question. It's a very important question, and it gave us an opportunity to talk about it. As I said, I don't know if I've been comprehensive, but all that I've said is actually what Swami has said on this topic. That, dear listeners, brings us to the end of this week's episode. If you have a question on practical spirituality and you'd like me to answer this on the show, send it to me. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. And if you can record your question in your own voice and send it to me, that would be fantastic. I'd love to play it in the voice of the questioner. If you wish to be anonymous, you can still send me a recording and you can mention that you wish to be anonymous. I can always not mention your name like I did today. Once again, thanks to the questioner for this very important question that was asked, and most humbly I offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful English song on the other side of it. The program by Raghu is going to continue. I'll be back at 12:30 for the afternoon satsang. But do join me again next week at 11 a.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Take my hand, Jesus, take my hand. take my hand and lead the way.
Sai Ram from Prashantinilayam. Thanks to the overwhelming response to Radio Sai's Karoke Sai Bhajans, released in July 2017. Here comes the second offering, a set of 9 bhajans. Bhajans, we also have the Sarvadharma prayer, the Asutoma Sardamaya hymn, as well as the Mangala Arati. And like before, you can download them from our website, radiosai.org. Please feel free to visit our website and use them in your Sai centers, in your Sai Bhajan sessions, and in your home to practice Sai Bhajans, to make every Sai Bhajan session an elevating and supremely fulfilling experience. Thank you so much. Sai Ram.